Welcome to Detroit Today. I'm Nick Austin, filling in for Stephen Henderson. These days, the Supreme Court has been on Americans' minds in a way that isn't always true. Once considered a bipartisan body of justices, it is now thought of as somewhat different. Almost half of all Americans now say the Supreme Court leans conservative, which is a 20% bump since 2 years ago, according to the Pew Research Center. The Dobbs decision overturning Roe likely had the biggest impact on these perceptions. But Dobbs wasn't the only important ruling that occurred this past summer. Cases involving gun control and religious freedom were also decided. And later in the show, we're going to talk about the new slate of cases that the Supreme Court is taking up and highlight the most important ones. But for now, we want to review the important cases the High Court decided this summer. What were the decisions, and how will they impact Americans going forward? How have Americans' perceptions of the court changed, and what might that mean for the institution moving forward? With court back in session and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson now sitting on the bench, we thought it was the perfect time to have this conversation. And here with us to talk about all of it, it's Anne Marimo, the legal affairs reporter for The Washington Post. Anne, welcome to Detroit Today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here with us, because there was a flurry of activity this summer with the Supreme Court. And I know for many of us, Dobbs is the case name that you hear all the time. But just so that we can reset this right now for those who don't know the particulars, what does Dobbs say and what does it do?
Right. So as you said, it really was a blockbuster of a term with a solidified conservative 6-3 majority asserting itself and moving sharply to the right. And the big one that got much of the headlines was the Dobbs decision. And in this case, the court was asked to uphold a ban on abortion at 15 weeks of pregnancy passed by the state of Mississippi, and also to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, which had guaranteed a national constitutional right to abortion for the last 50 years. Chief Justice John Roberts, a conservative, urged his colleagues to uphold the 15-week ban, but not to go as far as to overturn Roe v. Wade. He was not convincing to his colleagues, and by a 5-4 majority, the court did overturn the right to abortion nationwide. And as we saw quickly, many states controlled by Republican legislatures moved to restrict abortion severely. Some had what were called trigger bans that went into effect right away. And we're seeing that play out now throughout the country.
Yeah. And it's a decision, obviously, as you mentioned, with those trigger bans and things, had an immediate impact on many Americans, and also showed that when the conservative chief justice is not even able to sway people on his side, that there's a significant change in the court. How did Americans generally react to Dobbs?
Yes, as you said, public opinion polls are showing approval ratings at a historic low for the court, with respondents saying that the court is too conservative and out of step with the views of Americans. And we're seeing even the justices themselves over the summer speaking publicly about those approval ratings.
And we're going to get into kind of what this means for the court moving forward. But before we do that, again, looking back on this term this summer, another big decision is the one that occurred in New York, the decision from June 23rd, striking down a New York law that required people to show a specific need to carry a firearm in public. What did the Supreme Court say in that case, and how would that affect gun control nationwide?
Right. So your listeners may remember more than a decade ago in the landmark Heller decision, the Supreme Court for the first time said that the Second Amendment guarantees a right to own a firearm in your home for self-protection. The court went further and said for the first time that there is a constitutional right to carry a firearm in public places. Now, major cities around the country, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago have laws that require people to show a specific need and get a certain license that they want to carry in public. And those are very restrictive and means that a lot of people in those places do not have permits to carry in public. This decision by the court changes that and makes it easier for people to get a license to carry a gun in public places. So you've already seen in Maryland, the laws have changed. In New York, those laws are being debated now. But the lawmakers in those places have to make it easier for people to get a license to carry in public.
And we're speaking with Anne Marimo, legal affairs reporter for The Washington Post here on Detroit Today. And Anne, we've highlighted two cases that I know were very impactful this summer. But like we mentioned, there were a flurry of cases, a lot of significant decisions. From your reporting and speaking with people, what are some of the decisions that you think were very impactful we haven't mentioned that say something about the court and that listeners should know about?
Sure. The other two areas I would mention, the conservative majority also sharply curtailed the Biden administration's power to combat climate change and the EPA's authority to curb emissions from power plants. That's a significant case affecting, you know, what the government can do to ensure a healthy environment. The other area is in the role of religion in public life. The conservative majority has continued to shift towards allowing more public displays of religion. You may remember that the court sided with a football coach who had been fired for leading a prayer at a public high school with players and members of the community after a game. And the court said that no, that he had a constitutional right to do that. So that was another area where the court sort of strengthened the role of religion.
In looking at the opinions of this court that happened in this past term, moving forward in the current term, is there any general trend or through line that you're seeing? What do these past decisions?
Yes. So as you mentioned, yesterday was the first day that the new justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, joined the bench for oral argument. She was a very active questioner, participating in oral arguments. But she really doesn't change the makeup on the court with the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer. You have one liberal justice leaving and another taking his place. So I don't see any reason to think that the justices are going to sort of slow down this march to the right with more conservative opinions. And there are many coming up this term that will also be consequential for Americans.
And I think we're seeing, and more of the public is seeing, the court more as a political body now than they did before, as a maybe more of an independent judiciary, with them flexing their muscle the way they have in this past term and moving forward. But maybe a check on that would be what the legislature, the executive branch, could try to do to curtail that. Are there any ideas of things that people are debating in terms of trying to maybe get the court more in line with what the public believes it should be doing?
Yes. So early on in his term, President Biden did appoint a commission to study possible Supreme Court reforms. This is a bipartisan commission of lawyers and scholars, and they got together and studied proposals that have been out there, for instance, to expand the size of the court, or to impose term limits and get rid of life tenure for justices, and to try to ensure that each president has the same number of nominees so that the nomination process is less political. But this commission, like many before it, did not issue recommendations. It was more of a study. And as far as I know, none of those proposals have gone anywhere at this point.
Has anybody that you know of made any mention of things on the proposals, or is there think tanks or maybe in different lawmakers that have been drumming up maybe or trying to check support on some of these proposals?
Certainly Democratic lawmakers and outside interest groups have been pushing for it. But even Biden himself, I believe, as a candidate, said that he was not interested in favor of expanding the size of the court. I've read that proposals for term limits have had more traction, but as you know, The Congress may change hands, so I think it's unlikely that anything will get through Congress.
Right, right. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering about maybe more exotic proposals that were on there. You know, I've heard of things of maybe having a rotating panel of justices in which nine fit in and things. And, you know, something like this is probably going to take a little bit more outside the box thinking, because obviously there is the concern, hey, we might have Congress now, but we might not in the future. These things seem to be a little bit more bipartisan in their makeup, or maybe could have legs if they get support. What are some of the more expansive ideas you might have heard of? And again, is there any traction with those?
I don't see there being any traction. As you mentioned, there were some of those other proposals in this report that were studied, including sort of a rotating cast of judges from the appeals courts. I don't see that happening. I think that it was very unusual for President Trump to have three nominees so quickly that could change the direction of the court so dramatically. But I do not see any of those reform proposals gaining traction with the current makeup of Congress.
Again, we're speaking with Anne Marimo, legal affairs reporter for The Washington Post here on Detroit Today. And we also would like to speak with you. What do you make of the Supreme Court's recent decisions? Are you upset with the Supreme Court, or do you like how it has ruled? Do you think that the institution needs to change, or do you think the Supreme Court is still a partisan institution, or do you have an opinion on ways the court functions could be challenged? Do you believe the court has always been partisan, always been a political body? Give us a call, 313-577-1019. What would you do to reform the court? What is your public opinion of the court right now, as you are a member of the public, as we all are? But as I'm speaking with you right now, and I am kind of intrigued on what you're looking forward to in this new term, this upcoming term with the court. You already mentioned you saw day one. What are you really looking forward to in terms of this court this year?
Yeah, I think that some hard feelings from the last term are still persistent. As I mentioned, the justices have been out speaking publicly to various audiences over the summer, and it was surprising how sort of outspoken they were with their comments. You had Justice Kagan criticizing the court for overturning past precedents so quickly and the implications there. She had this comment in which she said, it just doesn't look like law when some new judges appointed by a new president come in and start tossing out the old stuff. It was really direct. And then you had Roberts sort of defending the credibility of the court, even though he himself had said the abortion decision to overturn Roe was a jolt that went too far. He said it's one thing to criticize our opinions, but another sort of to attack the institution and its credibility. So there are plenty of more decisions coming up and even today about voting rights and then other big case about affirmative action and college admissions and whether universities can continue to use race in a limited way to make admissions decisions. So I think these ones will really test the court and be the ones to watch.
And those are some cases we will be getting into and unpacking a little bit later on to everyone listening here, as we've got a great guest to dive into the law on those cases. But before we get to calls, I do have one question for you, Anne, because you mentioned how there's been more sniping, more public discussion by members of the court, by justices, which we don't see very often.
No.
but that tells me then that the talk and the discussion and public opinion is having an effect on the court. Now, whether that means they'll try to dig in more or get more obstinate, or whether that might curtail them back forward, it does show that the justices do have ears and they do react to things that are happening, which is one of the reasons why maybe pressure from the legislature could actually have an impact on getting them back in line, like we've seen in the history. If the lawmakers are not going to institute any of these changes, what have you heard about ways they are working on or thinking about trying to get the Supreme Court back in line, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, our country is set up, our government, with separation of powers. The judicial branch is independent. And there are questions about, really what Congress could do in terms of oversight. I think there would be real challenges to any efforts to insert Congress into the work of the courts, and the court would resist that. And there would be questions about, whether or not that was constitutional. They're aware of public opinion. You saw open its doors to the public for the first time since the pandemic and take down a lot of the big fencing that was surrounding the court after the leak of the Dobbs decision. And they also are allowing live streaming of their oral arguments again after the pandemic. So I do think they are trying to be more open to the public in that sense.
Yeah, it was. I was going to ask you about the live streaming. Do you think that was a response to some of the criticism or just carrying over things that happened from the pandemic? Why was this the time to allow live streaming of these sessions?
Yeah, I also think it was a practical matter. I think they saw that it really was not problematic during the pandemic and, in fact, led to, I'm sure you know, Justice Clarence Thomas asking more questions. And it was popular. That was one thing that came out of the Supreme Court Commission from the Biden administration, that the public really did appreciate being able to listen live. Even though the court is back open to the public, it's very hard to get a seat in the courtroom if people line up for a big case sometimes overnight to try to get a seat. So making it available in live streaming really does open up access and I think is popular.
There's nothing I love more than sitting down with a batch of freshly made chocolate chip cookies and watching some Supreme Court opinions live streaming, I got to tell you. As we're speaking to Ann Marimo, legal affairs reporter for The Washington Post here on Detroit Today, and we're going to speak with you. Give us a call, 313-577-1019, as we go to Abigail in Berkeley to start us off. Abigail, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. What you got? What's your point?
I think the legitimacy of the court was really called into question when a twice impeached, twice lost the popular vote president was allowed to appoint as many justices as he did, particularly with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. I think that was a heartbreaking moment for me and many other women who still to this day have a lot of questions about that man and whether or not it's appropriate for him to be representing us on the highest court.
You know, you bring up a really good point, Abigail, and thank you for your call. I was always intrigued by the questioning of a justice who I think it's fair to state impeached himself on the bench. I mean, regardless of the facts surrounding or what they were trying to say he was responsible for, he did lie about it. And he lied about that under oath, which is a really big issue. I give the question to you, Anne, in terms of the legitimacy with a twice impeached Donald Trump nominating and getting so many people on the bench as he did, also not winning the popular vote. Has there been any thought of reforms based on that, or what are you hearing based on those points from Abigail in Berkeley?
Yeah, I mean, I think there the way in which, many of the Trump justices came to hold these seats does, raise public concern, as you saw with Justice Ginsburg passing away and how quickly the Senate moved to push through Justice Barrett's nomination as well. After the election, after people had started voting already. And so I think, it just raises a lot of questions about the confirmation process, the power of Mitch McConnell to so quickly push through those judges. And I do see Democrats trying to take a page from the Trump era and quickly move through judicial nominations at a faster pace than before and even closer to the election than before. But these openings on the court only come up so often. And so I don't know that they'll be able to, make a big difference there.
Right, right. And again, I admit perjure. When he perjured himself by lying under oath, as you are listening to Detroit Today here on 101.9 WDET. Happy to be joined by Ann Marimo, legal affairs reporter for The Washington Post. And as the Supreme Court starts its historic term here with four women on the bench, Ketanji Brown Jackson being the latest to join, we want to speak with you as well. What thoughts do you have about the court? What are you looking forward to in this coming term? And do you have any questions about the last term that we can provide to our guest as we continue right now with Joe in Rochester? Joe, go ahead. You're on Detroit Today.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. One regarding, is there an actual process to remove a justice that's already been appointed? And also, is there any accountability legally or otherwise for justices that have lied or misled the public and Congress when they were vetted to be appointed?
Very good questions, Joe. I leave those for you. And is there a process for those two things?
Yes. So it rarely happens, has happened in our history. I believe it's only around a dozen federal judges have ever been impeached, and maybe one Supreme Court justice in history. The power is given to Congress to remove federal judges with life tenure, and it's done through a similar process to the president, I believe, through impeachment in the House and then conviction by the Senate. You did hear Senator Susan Collins, after the Roe decision was overturned in Dobbs, say that she felt like she had been misled by Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch during their conversations with her, but I have not heard that there are any genuine steps being taken to try to start the impeachment process.
A very, very good question, Joe in Rochester. Thank you so much for giving us a call here on Detroit Today. It's kind of one of those things, Anne, I always think about when you wonder if people think they can do their job with impunity. There's always this thought, lifetime tenure for a Supreme Court justice. They'll be less beholden to any sway or being manipulated in any way. But then again, if there's not any oversight for them, how do you keep a justice in check and not do something? Like go back or maybe perjure themselves or do something that would be an impeachable performance. From what I'm hearing, though, not a lot of thoughts in terms of how to increase oversight. So this is the bench that we have right now. What are the people that you're talking to most looking forward to, again, in this upcoming term with the court?
Yeah, Nick, I was just going to mention, I mean, another area in terms of accountability, the justices also police themselves when it comes to recusal and conflict of interest right. in various cases. So we saw in the last term that Justice Clarence Thomas did not recuse from a case about the January 6th attack on the Capitol, even though we subsequently found out that his wife, Ginni Thomas, had been sending texts and messages to people at the White House, to members of legislatures around the country, calling for an investigation into the election, calling the election fraud. And so there's nothing that could be done there to sort of force the justice to recuse from that case. So that's another area where the justices have resisted oversight.
Yeah, that's an excellent point there. And meanwhile, we've already seen Ketanji Brown Jackson in her limited time recuse herself from a case involving Harvard. How about that?
That's right. That's right.
And thank you so much for joining us here on Detroit Today, as it was very helpful to get that history. And we'd love to have you back on in the future.
Thanks for your interest.
All right, coming up on Detroit Today, we will take a look at the future, the current slate of cases, and what we need to be looking forward to with the guest I'm looking forward to speak with, and I know you will as well, Tom Wolf, Deputy Director with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, joins us next as we continue with Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET.
WDET is your connection to what's happening in Detroit.
WDET is your place for open dialogue about the issues that impact you.
Stay in the know.
This is WDET FM,
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET, and I'm Nick Austin, filling in for Stephen Henderson as we prepare for, again, the start of a historic term with the U.S. Supreme Court. Four women accompanying the five men on the bench to begin the term, first time in the history of this body, but also it occurs in the backdrop of the 6-3 supermajority held by the conservative wing. What does that mean for our democracy, and what cases do we need to be paying attention to as we go forward in this term? To help us learn more about what to watch, I'm joined by Tom Wolf. He is the deputy director with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where he leads the center's census project and other major constitutional litigation initiatives. Tom, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks for having me.
So there's been a lot of buzz about how significant this term could be for the U.S. Supreme Court and the American population in general. Can you give us an idea in a general sense of what has these observers so concerned?
I think as folks covered in the last segment, we saw the Supreme Court, particularly after Justice Barrett was seated, shifting wildly to the right. And unfortunately, that trend seems set to continue, or at least the threat of it hovers over this term, as the court has lined up a series of cases dealing with everything from voting rights to political representation to affirmative action that may give the court openings, if it so chooses, to push policy and law even further in rightward directions.
Yeah, and we were speaking again earlier about voting rights being one of those significant issues with Anne. While I have you now, can you tell us what is the concern? What's the case involved? What are the cases involving voting rights, and what are the concerns with those cases?
So today, in about a half an hour, the court's going to start hearing argument in a case called Merrill v. Milligan, which is a voting rights case coming out of Alabama. And then a little deeper in the year, we're likely to see a case called Moore v. Harper, which is a partisan gerrymandering case coming out of North Carolina that potentially raises a fringe but very dangerous legal theory called the independent state legislature theory. Happy to unpack either of those as you're interested.
I would love you to unpack both of them right now. Go ahead.
All right, so let's take Merrill because that's the first one up. It's, as I said, happening in about a half an hour. That case concerns the Voting Rights Act and black voters in Alabama. So here's the basic deal in that case. In Alabama, the Black Belt, which stretches across the central part of the state, is very densely populated with black voters. In fact, there are enough black voters that there could be at least two congressional districts in that state that would allow those voters to elect their candidates of choice. However, in Alabama, they've been split up. They've basically been spread across four districts, three districts where their numbers are kept around 30%, and one district where there are way more black voters than would be needed for them to carry that district. And so their claim below was essentially that they'd been both cracked and packed to dilute their ability to elect candidates of their choice unjustly and in violation of the Voting Rights Act. So they actually won below. There was a unanimous ruling in their favor from a panel that even included two judges appointed by Donald Trump. The state appealed. They took it up to the Supreme Court. They asked for the court to basically suspend the ruling below, which would have struck the map down for use this fall. The court agreed. And so that illegal map is being used for elections this fall. And now the question going forward is what map should be used in future elections. So they're raising a series of challenges. The state, their main challenge is basically claiming that the Voting Rights Act would require them to consider race in drawing districts. That's unconstitutional. And they are also arguing with a little bit more complexity here, that the Voting Rights Act doesn't apply to questions about how you draw individual districts. All it does is bar what are known as multi-member districts, so one district that elects multiple candidates, or at-large election systems where everyone in the state votes for every candidate. That would be a radical rewriting of the Voting Rights Act. And so we're hoping that the court doesn't move in that direction.
Yeah.
That's what's up today.
Yeah, that'd be radical. And I thought this was handled with the countless number of times the Voting Rights Act has been challenged and we have case law on it. Does the court appear poised to actually go in that direction? Is that something that could happen?
You know, it's possible. The difficulty here is that what the court is being asked to do clearly flies in the face of what the statute is meant to do. So the Voting Rights Act has existed now for almost 60 years. If I'm doing math right, it's still a little early in the morning. So 1965.
I co-signed.
And the idea, and the idea was basically that various communities should have an equal opportunity to elect their candidates. And that doesn't mean that every community gets a candidate. It just means if your community is large enough and it votes together enough that if you could pull together a majority, you could get a candidate that you would like to represent you. It was specifically designed to deal with racial discrimination in voting. And so The whole notion of it is that race needs to be taken into account. Now, that's not the only thing that map drawers take into account. I could get into the deep technicalities, but the basic idea is you need to show that you have a community that's large enough, that votes together enough, that other communities vote against, so you can't get enough crossover votes from other communities, so your community is really distinct, and you're close enough in physical space that you could draw a district that wouldn't look crazy. So you need to take a lot of things into account.
Yeah.
The court is being asked in part to say, actually, you can't take race into account when you're trying to cure racial discrimination. And now this relates to a much longer running trend in Supreme Court jurisprudence that relates largely to how the court interprets the 14th Amendment. You know, initially the 14th Amendment was designed to eliminate subordination. It was about slavery. But increasingly, as the court's grown more conservative, it's tried to rewrite that clause of the Constitution or that amendment in the Constitution to be more about classification and just kind of putting people in different groups on the basis of their race. And so while I would hope that the court wouldn't move in the direction that Alabama is requesting, Alabama in a lot of senses is sort of trying to push the court in ways it's already leaning.
I thought I heard you say that they're trying to say that you can't cure race discrimination by considering race, which is maybe one of the most mind-boggling sentences I've ever heard in my life. Is this really an argument that's being put forward and that might carry water?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's something that the Supreme Court itself over the course of time has really given a lot of airtime to. It relates a little bit to the same dynamic that's going on with this independent state legislature theory, but Alabama in many ways is repeating some things back to the court that we've already heard from the court earlier, including from Chief Justice Roberts.
Right. We're speaking to Tom Wolf, again, Deputy Director with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program here on 101.9 WDET. Before we get into affirmative action and how that may be at risk a little bit later, briefly, can you tell us, you referenced Moore v. Harper also. Why would that be important as to voting rights?
So Moore v. Harper is a case where a group of gerrymanderers down in North Carolina are basically asking the Supreme Court to eliminate the traditional system of checks and balances that's governed the country for the last two centuries when it comes to making rules for federal elections. So that potentially has a big impact. And, these two cases that we've now mentioned are related in a way. So let's start actually with Moore, although it hasn't been scheduled for argument yet. What Moore is basically saying is that when it comes time to make laws or rules for federal elections, only state legislatures can make them. Governors can't veto them. Courts can't interpret those laws. People can't pass ballot initiatives. Election officials can't create rules and regulations and guidance or even interpret those statutes. So legislature is supreme. And then the only body that's going to be able to judge whether they're doing it correctly or not is the U.S. Supreme Court. So for something like partisan gerrymandering, which is also about redistricting, just like Merrill is, if you have a problem, the Supreme Court's already said the court can't get involved in gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering cases. You also wouldn't be able to bring them in the state courts under state law. So no more solutions for partisan gerrymandering in the courts. For voting rights more generally, if you're worried about the way your state legislature drew your congressional map, the Supreme Court's saying governor can't veto, state courts can't do anything about it. You need to bring the case to the federal courts, and that mainly means us, the Supreme Court, and we'll be the judges. But at the same time, through cases like Merrill, last term, the Brnovich case, and going even further back in time, the Shelby County case, now it's more than a decade old, the Supreme Court's gutted the Voting Rights Act. And so there aren't really a lot of protections left if you care about those issues.
Yeah, it sounds like the Supreme Court is gutting the ability of people to get to courts in order to seek redress for wrongs when it comes to voting, from what I'm hearing, as again, we're speaking about the current term, the new term of the Supreme Court with Tom Wolf of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. And we want to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 313-577-1019. What questions do you have about the Supreme Court's new term? In fact, what do you think and know about redistricting? And have you lost your confidence in the Supreme Court? What would you need to see? What would need to happen for you to get your confidence to return? And how do you think that the Supreme Court has too much unchecked power right now, or are they doing what they need to do to be a check on the other branches of government? 313-577-1019, and we'll work you into the conversation. Another case I heard mentioned a little bit earlier, Tom, that I want to present to you. There was a discussion about affirmative action being in play with the courts, though I thought that issue was settled earlier in cases like Bollinger. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening, why the Supreme Court is considering affirmative action and what's going on there, what we can expect?
Yeah, well, you know, this is an issue that the Brennan Center's Democracy Program is less involved with, but, you know, I can talk about the kind of broad overarching theme here, and it's related to what I raised earlier. So, you know, ultimately, all of these cases are about this sort of attempt to shift the way the court thinks about how courts and other governmental entities should deal with racial discrimination and the after effects of systemic, historic racial integration or discrimination. So the 14th Amendment was originally designed, as I sort of flagged, to deal with slavery and the after effects of slavery. It was about people being subordinated by other people. And the idea at the highest level was we need to do whatever we need to do as a society and as a political body to make sure that one group of people is no longer below another group of people and held down by another group of people. But what we've seen over the course of the last few decades, as the court's conservative majority, or in this case, supermajority, has started to reassert itself after sort of a brief period in the 20th century when the court was extremely liberal, is that general approach to both the 14th Amendment and thinking about racial discrimination more generally has gone away. And there is much more of a focus now on this notion that somehow grouping people in different groups because of their race or treating them differently because of their race is actually the most offensive thing that someone could do. So it's not about fixing subordination anymore. It's about essentially colorblindness. And so when that value starts being interjected into the way courts interpret statutes and programs that were created to end subordination, you get into some very strange territories. Like you get the court saying, like in a redistricting case, you can't consider race when you're drawing lines under a statute that's asking you to make sure that specific racial groups aren't being subordinated anymore.
Yeah, like you can't consider lines when creating lines for a district. We're speaking with Tom. We're speaking with Tom Wolfe, deputy director with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. And coming up, we're going to speak with you as well. Give us a call, 313-577-1019, as we will continue our discussion about the current term of the U.S. Supreme Court with you when we return. Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET, where I'm Nick Austin, filling in for Stephen Henderson and giving you a preview of the term that just started with the U.S. Supreme Court, joined by Tom Wolfe, the deputy director with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. And Tom, before we took that little break, you were mentioning some of the trends that you were seeing with the court in terms of their decision related to considering race when it came to redistricting. We've also seen that since Amy Coney Barrett joined the court, there's been a bit of a shift, a significant shift in the court. Are there any other trends that you're monitoring and concerned about or seeing that will affect this term? And what are they?
Oh, for certain. And so I think, you know, one trend that we saw a lot last term that we hope we don't see repeated this term is the court's use of the so-called shadow docket to decide important issues. So the basic idea, you know, is that in a democratic system where we invest a lot of power in the court, you know, and these folks who have lifetime appointments who, you know, essentially can't be removed That when they make decisions that affect all of us, that they're clear about their reasons and do it in a transparent and reasonable way. The court traditionally has dealt with big issues on what's called its merits docket. So it's the stuff that people are probably most familiar with. You know, people prepare briefs, people travel to Washington, D.C., and they stand up in court and they make their arguments in front of the nine justices, and the justices, you know, issue an opinion a few months later that lays out their thinking, you know, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. Usually you get dozens and dozens of pages explaining their thinking. What the court has done increasingly is use its emergency appeals docket to decide issues while simultaneously not really admitting that that's what they're doing, let alone providing reasons for what they're doing. And we saw this, you know, deeply impact redistricting last term. We saw it had effects on abortion rights in places like Texas. These are real consequential things that the court is doing without the benefit of real briefing, and then they make the decisions and they don't really justify them. And, you know, hence the use of the term shadow docket. Now, I think this dynamic is important to keep in mind when we think about a case like Moore v. Harper, the independent state legislature theory case that is being briefed up right now and will probably be argued either, you know, sometime between Thanksgiving and Christmas or sometime early next year. So in Moore v. Harper, there's this idea that's being circulated that under the U.S. Constitution, state legislatures are the only state body that can make rules when it comes to elections. This is a notion that was really mainstreamed by election litigation in 2020 around the outcome of the presidential election, where particularly the Trump campaign attempting to change the results, you know, started bringing these sorts of claims. They should have been dead in the water because they're based on nothing. But a few Supreme Court justices, in their various writings on the shadow docket, started to give new life to the theory by suggesting that they were at least curious to see what people could make of it. Mm. And so immediately, once the court signals that it's interested in something or that they might change their mind about something, litigants start acting like the law's already changed. So We started seeing this theory popping up more and more, and it popped up in North Carolina around this partisan gerrymandering issue, and now it's in front of the court. Now, folks who've been listening to me so far, when I'm talking about kind of a rightward lurch in the court, might think that I'm pessimistic here. I think I just want to make sure folks understand that while the court's moving right, I think there are still opportunities to stop that, at least with particular issues. And this independent state legislature theory is one of them. How does this relate to the shadow docket? The court thus far, when justices have been giving air to the ISLT, have been doing it through the shadow docket, where there's basically no briefing, there's no argument. Now that the court's decided to hear the case, it's in a very different world. By the time the court actually convenes to hear arguments, they will have gotten hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of briefing explaining what the facts actually are, what the history actually is, what the law actually is. They'll have to battle it out in public, and then they'll have to put out an opinion that all of them have their names on. And I think that any justice, regardless of their ideology or persuasions here, will have a very difficult time writing an opinion that endorses the independent state legislature theory.
We're speaking again with Tom Wolfe, and we want to speak with you right now, 313-577-1019. Tom, I'm going to get back to you on some more solutions and opportunities to stop it, as you mentioned. But first, we have Mark in Detroit. Mark, go ahead. You're on Detroit Today.
Hey, good morning, y'all. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, I have both. One thing I want to say, I don't believe that there's any way to really legislate the decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States, because the Constitution wasn't designed for it to be that way. It wanted the Supreme Court to be independent in the decision-making as it involves the Constitution of the United States. The problem with the Supreme Court, from what I see, is that they have the ability to interpret the Constitution with basically whatever way they choose to. And so the problem is not in the Supreme Court, even though we know that some of our justices are subject, actually all of them are subject to political persuasions. The problem itself is the Constitution itself when it comes to that. And so we need to try to find a way to be able to deal with that particular part of it as far as making changes in the Constitution. But even with that, you cannot legislate the decision-making of the Supreme Court. But what we can do in regards to elections, I believe that one of the solutions, the possible solutions to that problem, is to make legislation that provides for all federal elected officials to be elected, not so much via each independent or each state and their rules, but by one federal statute that pertains to federal elections. Because by having each individual state decides who an elector in their states for the presidency or Congress, you know, that creates all kind of problems and potential ways to subvert the will of the people. But if you make a federal statute that pertains to all federal elections, that takes away from the power of the state to decide who can vote for the president and Congress in the United States.
Mark, I'm really close to giving you your own constitutional law podcast. I got to say, that was one of the most succinctly well put summaries I've ever heard. But I present that to you, Tom. Go ahead with your response.
We need voting rights reform at the federal level.
Right.
It's actually quite a shame because there was a movement earlier this year to renovate the Voting Rights Act and supplement it to make sure that it actually did the work it needs to do. And that would also be a way of tamping down the threat posed by the independent state legislature theory. And to the caller's point, I think it was Mark, you know, the Supreme Court, when it's making interpretations of what federal statutes say, like the Voting Rights Act in Merrill or Brnovich or Shelby County, is just offering its interpretation of a law that Congress created. If Congress isn't satisfied with the way that the courts interpreted a statute, it's free to pass a new statute that says, no, this is the way it should be read. This is what it really right. means. And so there's a responsibility for our elected officials to step up and push back to against the court when the court oversteps.
Excellent point, Tom. I mean, it's kind of gamesmanship with the state of our ability to legislate right now. As we move to Hunter in Detroit. Hunter, coming up on the end, but I really want to get your question in there. Go ahead. You're on Detroit Today.
Well, I know the conservatives on the court are originalists or textualists of convenience, but they use the wording in the Constitution to justify some idiocy. But what is there any textual support for the independent state legislature theory? Because I don't know where that would be in the Constitution.
Go ahead, Tom.
And second question is if it does prevail, what's going to happen to Michigan and other states with independent commissions?
Go ahead, Tom.
All right, so I guess I've got 3 points to rattle through. So the proponents of the independent state legislature theory, their entire case is based on a few words in the Elections Clause in the U.S. Constitution that basically says the state legislature shall make the rules for federal elections. And they say, okay, well, there it says, state legislature. If they said legislature, they really mean it. It must mean the state legislature to the exclusion of all other people. That's our textual argument. Well, you need to keep reading the text. And so if you continue reading the Elections Clause, it says also in that sort of same stream of thought, Congress shall have the ability to override what the states do or, you know, create their own laws whole cloth. That's a rough paraphrase. But when we say Congress in the text of the Constitution, we're not assuming that Congress can't be reviewed by the Supreme Court. So why should we assume that state legislatures can't be reviewed by state courts? In fact, if you agree with the independent state legislature theory, then I guess Congress isn't subject to oversight by the Supreme Court when it makes voting laws. And so all of the laws that the Supreme Court has destroyed about voting, like the VRA, all of those precedents go away and Congress can do whatever it wants. And I don't think the Supreme Court wants that outcome. So the textual argument doesn't really hold any weight with me. But I think it's also important to understand kind of generally what the framers were up to when they made the Constitution. They came to Philadelphia because what was going on in the states had basically made America ungovernable. They had a real suspicion and distrust of state legislatures. So the thought that they would have created a system that would have given state legislatures unchecked authority to decide who actually ends up running the federal government is so far off the map. It's hard to think that people ever learned American history. I mean, ultimately what this case is about, it's about checks and balances. There isn't really anything more historically American about our government than that. Checks and balances. If laws get made, there are multiple people who are involved, including the people themselves. Moore v. Harper would ask the Supreme Court to melt down checks and balances and give state legislatures basically unchecked authority to decide what they want to do, including undermine your vote.
Yeah, well, Tom, the only check I have on this program is time, and I'm running out of it. So in the future, we got to have you back on. But thanks so much for joining us and giving us that great primer on what to look forward to this term in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks to the callers, too.
Thank you. And that is going to do it for us today on Detroit Today. But tune in tomorrow when we are going to discuss or speak with Tom Barrett. He's going to talk. He's a state senator. He's going to talk about why he's running for the 7th Congressional District. That's going to do it for us on Detroit Today here on 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll see you tomorrow.